Chapter 17. One definite immediate fact stuck in his quivering grasp. He must give the girl every chance, must hold himself passive till less he had taken them. In the court Effie ran up to him with her leaping terrier. I was coming out to meet you and Owen. Miss Viner was coming too, and then she couldn't, because she's got such a headache. I'm afraid I gave it to her, because I did my division so disgracefully. It's too bad, isn't it? But won't you walk back with me? Nurse won't mind the least bit. She'd so much rather go into tea. Darrow excused himself laughingly, on the plea that he had letters to write, which was much worse than having a headache, and not infrequently resulted in one. Oh, then you can go and write them in Owen's study. That's where gentlemen always write their letters. She flew on with her dog and Darrow pursued his way to the house. Effie's suggestion struck him as useful. He had pictured himself as vaguely drifting about the drawing rooms, and had perceived the difficulty of Miss Viner's having to seek him there. But the study, a small room on the right of the hall, was in easy sight from the staircase, and so situated that there would be nothing marked in his being found there in talk with her. He went in, leaving the door open, and sat down at the writing table. The room was a friendly, heterogeneous place, the one repository, in the well-ordered and amply servanted house, of all its unclassified odds and ends. Effie's croquet box and fishing rods, Owen's guns and golf sticks and rackets, his stepmother's flower baskets and gardening implements, even Madame de Chantel's embroidery frame, and the back numbers of the Catholic Weekly. The early twilight had begun to fall, and presently a slanting ray across the desk showed Darrow that a servant was coming across the hall with a lamp. He pulled out a sheet of notepaper, and began to write at random, while the man, entering, put the lamp at his elbow, and vaguely straightened the heap of newspapers tossed on the divan. Then his steps died away, and Darrow sat leaning his head on his locked hands. Presently another step sounded on the stairs, wavered a moment, and then moved past the threshold of the study. Darrow got up and walked into the hall, which was still unlighted. In the dimness he saw Sophie Viner standing by the hall door in her hat and jacket. She stopped at sight of him, her hand on the door bolt, and they stood for a second without speaking. "Have you seen Effie?" she suddenly asked. "He went out to meet you." "She did meet me, just now, in the court. She's gone on to join her brother." Darrow spoke as naturally as he could, but his voice sounded to his own ears like an amateur actor's in a light part. Miss Viner, without answering, drew back the bolt. He watched her in silence as the door swung open. Then he said, "She has her nurse with her. She won't be long." She stood irresolute, and he added, "I was writing in there, won't you come and have a little talk? Everyone's out." The last words struck him as not well chosen, but there was no time to choose. She paused a second longer, and then crossed the threshold of the study. At luncheon S.E. had sat with her back to the window, and beyond noting that S.E. had grown a little thinner, and had less color and vivacity, he had seen no change in her. But now, as the lamplight fell on her face, its whiteness startled him. "Poor thing. Poor thing, what in heaven's name can she suppose?" he wondered. "Do sit down, I want to talk to you," he said and pushed a chair toward her. She did not seem to see it, or, if she did, she deliberately chose another seat. He came back to his own chair, and leaned his elbows on the blotter. She faced him from the farther side of the table. "You promised to let me hear from you now and then," he began awkwardly, and with a sharp sense of his awkwardness. A faint smile made her face more tragic. "Did I? There was nothing to tell. I've had no history like the happy countries." He waited a moment before asking, "You are happy here?" "I was," she said with a faint emphasis. "Why do you say was? You're surely not thinking of going? There can't be kinder people anywhere." Darrow hardly knew what he was saying, but her answer came to him with deadly definiteness. "I suppose it depends on you, whether I go or stay. On me? He stared at her across Owen's scattered papers. Good God! What can you think of me, to say that? The mockery of the question flashed back at him from her wretched face. She stood up, wandered away, and leaned an instant in the darkening window frame. From there she turned to fling back at him, colon, don't imagine I'm the least bit sorry for anything. He steadied his elbows on the table, and hid his face in his hands. It was harder, oh, damnably harder, than he had expected. Arguments, expedients, palliations, evasions, all seemed to be slipping away from him. He was left face to face with the mere graceless fact of his inferiority. He lifted his head to ask at random, colon, you've been here, then, ever since? Since June, yes. It turned out that the Farlows were hunting for me all the while for this. She stood facing him, her back to the window, evidently impatient to be gone, yet with something still to say, or that she expected to hear him say. The sense of her expectancy benumbed him. What in heaven's name could he say to her that was not an offense or a mockery? Your idea of the theater, you gave that up at once, then? Oh, the theater. She gave a little laugh. Couldn't wait for the theater. I had to take the first thing that offered. I took this. He pushed on haltingly, colon, I'm glad, extremely glad you're happy here. Dot dot, I'd counted on your letting me know if there was anything I could do. Dot dot, the theater, now if you still regret it, if you're not contented here. Dot dot, I know people in that line in London, I'm certain I can manage it for you. When I get back, she moved up to the table and leaned over it to ask, in a voice that was hardly above a whisper, colon, then you do want me to leave? Is that it? He dropped his arms with a groan. Good heavens! How can you think such things? At the time, you know, I begged you to let me do what I could, but you wouldn't hear of it. Dot dot, and ever since I've been wanting to be of use, to do something, anything, to help you. Dot, she heard him through, motionless, without a quiver of the clasped hands she rested on the edge of the table. If you want to help me, then you can help me to stay here, she brought out with low-toned intensity. Through the stillness of the pause which followed, the bray of a motor horn sounded far down the drive. Instantly she turned, with a last white look at him, and fled from the room, and up the stairs. He stood motionless, benumbed by the shock of her last words. She was afraid, then afraid of him, sick with fear of him. The discovery beat him down to a lower depth. Dot dot, the motor horn sounded again, close at hand, and he turned and went up to his room. His letter writing was a sufficient pretext for not immediately joining the party about the tea table, and he wanted to be alone, and try to put a little order into his tumultuous thinking. Upstairs, the room held out the intimate welcome of its lamp and fire. Everything in it exhaled the same sense of peace and stability which, 2 evenings before, had lulled him to complacent meditation. His armchair again invited him from the hearth. But he was too agitated to sit still, and with sunk head and hands clasped behind his back he began to wander up and down the room. His 5 minutes with Sophie Viner had flashed strange lights into the shadowy corners of his consciousness. The girl's absolute candor, her hard, ardent honesty, was for the moment the vividest point in his thoughts. He wondered anew, as he had wondered before, at the way in which the harsh discipline of life had stripped her of false sentiment without laying the least touch on her pride. When they had parted, 5 months before, as he had quietly but decidedly rejected all his offers of help, even to the suggestion of his trying to further her theatrical aims. As he had made it clear that she wished their brief alliance to leave no trace on their lives, save that of its own smiling memory. But now that they were unexpectedly confronted in a situation which seemed, to her terrified fancy, to put her at his mercy, her first impulse was to defend her right to the place as he had won, and to learn as quickly as possible if he meant to dispute it. While he had pictured her as shrinking away from him in a tremor of self-effacement as he had watched his movements, made sure of her opportunity, and come straight down to ave it out with him. He was so struck by the frankness and energy of the proceeding that for a moment he lost sight of the view of his own character implied in it. Poor thing. Poor thing. He could only go on saying, and with the repetition of the words the picture of himself as she must see him pitiably took shape again. He understood then, for the first time, how vague, in comparison with hers, had been his own vision of the part he had played in the brief episode of their relation. The incident had left in him a sense of exasperation and self-contempt, but that, as he now perceived, was chiefly, if not altogether, as it bore on his preconceived ideal of his attitude toward another woman. He had fallen below his own standard of sentimental loyalty, and if he thought of Sophie Viner it was mainly as the chance instrument of his lapse. These considerations were not agreeable to his pride, but they were forced on him by the example of her valiant common sense. If he had cut a sorry figure in the business, he owed it to her, not to close his eyes to the fact any longer. But when he opened them, what did he see? The situation, detestable at best, would yet have been relatively simple if protecting Sophie Viner had been the only duty involved in it. The fact that that duty was paramount did not do away with the contingent obligations. It was Darrow's instinct, in difficult moments, to go straight to the bottom of the difficulty. But he had never before had to take so dark a dive as this, and for the minute he shivered on the brink. Well, his first duty, at any rate, was to the girl. He must let her see that he meant to fulfill it to the last jot, and then try to find out how to square the fulfillment with the other problems already in his path. XVI, in the Oak Room he found Mrs. Leith, her mother-in-law and Effie. The group, as he came toward it down the long drawing rooms, composed itself prettily about the tea table. The lamps and the fire crossed their gleams on silver and porcelain, on the bright haze of Effie's hair, and on the whiteness of Anna's forehead, as she leaned back in her chair behind the tea urn. She did not move at Darrow's approach, but lifted to him a deep gaze of peace and confidence. The look seemed to throw about him the spell of a divine security. He felt the joy of a convalescent suddenly waking, to find the sunlight on his face. Madame de Chantel, across her knitting, discoursed of their afternoon's excursion, with occasional pauses induced by the hypnotic effect of the fresh air, and Effie, kneeling on the hearth, softly but insistently sought to implant in her terrier's mind some notion of the relation between a vertical attitude and sugar. Darrow took a chair behind the little girl, so that he might look across at her mother. It was almost a necessity for him, at the moment, to let his eyes rest on Anna's face, and to meet, now and then, the proud shyness of her gaze. Madame de Chantel presently inquired what had become of Owen, and a moment later the window behind her opened, and her grandson, gun in hand, came in from the terrace. As he stood there in the lamplight, with dead leaves and bits of bramble clinging to his mud-spattered clothes, the scent of the night about him, and its chill on his pale bright face, he really had the look of a young fawn strayed in from the forest. Effie abandoned the terrier to fly to him. H. Owen, where in the world have you been? I walked miles and miles with nurse, and couldn't find you, and we met John, and he said he didn't know where you'd gone. Nobody knows where I go, or what I see when I get there, that's the beauty of it, he laughed back at her. But if you're good, he added, I'll tell you about it one of these days. Oh, now, Owen, now. I don't really believe I'll ever be much better than I am now. Let Owen have his tea first, her mother suggested. But the young man, declining the offer, propped his gun against the wall, and, lighting a cigarette, began to pace up and down the room in a way that reminded Darrow of his own caged wanderings. Effie pursued him with her blandishments, and for a while he poured out to her a low-voiced stream of nonsense. Then he sat down beside his stepmother and leaned over to help himself to tea. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.